My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Mike.
It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak or do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very grateful to be here tonight. And I want to thank Sam for inviting me down, and it's just a big honor. I was thinking about something one of my pigeons told me one time. You know, he said, "Oh, I love speaking." I said, "Yeah, I really do." He said, "All the way up to about 10 minutes before I get up on the podium, then I wish somebody else was doing it." Now I know that feeling. You get the nerves. Well, let me say right off the bat, I'm not here to impress or depress. I'm here to express, and that helped take away the nerves, you know, because that's what it's all about. In the big book, it talks about, you know, we share in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now, and I'll attempt to do some of that for you tonight. I'm trying not to get in too long a drunk log. I think we all know how to drink unsuccessfully, and but I need to tell you some of it because I need to remember it. I had my first drink on October 16th, and it was either 1953 or 54. I'm not sure of the year, but I'm positive of the date. There's a story behind that, of course. Not that I had that great memory and it meant that much to me. I couldn't even tell you what it was. It was a beer. And then I had my first cigarette. Now, I do remember that was an L&M. That impressed me. That was more important at the time than the beer, but they were both important because it made me feel like a part of and a grown-up. And back when I was being raised, you know, your children were to be seen and not heard, and sometimes not even seen too much. And this one aunt of mine, who was my favorite aunt, who was the one who gave me my first beer, at the time was a practicing alcoholic. But it just maybe she was one of the few people, and I don't think we ever had an eyeball-to-eyeball conversation, but I was always comfortable around her. Now, I don't know if it was the alcoholics are attracted to each other or potentials are there. I don't think I was an alcoholic from my first drink. I think you got to earn your wings. But there was always a closeness I had with her. Ironically, I had my last drink on October 16th, many years later. And it was like I said, and the reason I know it was October 16th on the first end, well, she told me one time, I took care of her in her later years and or oversaw things. I didn't really take care of her. I just kind of oversaw things. But we were talking one day, and she had many years. She died with 48 years in the program, so she knew something about it. But she said she remembered that, and she often, for a long time after I came to the program, felt bad about that maybe she had started me on the path. And I said, no. I said, that path was already lined up. And, you know, I had self-will run riot from day two, you know. Don't worry about it. But she told me the reason I know it was October 16th because it was her birthday. And she said my second mother was dying of cancer, and I was visiting her a lot. And I was over there, and she didn't want to drink alone on her birthday. And that sounds good to me. So anyway, the big book, it also talks about that alcohol is but a symptom of deeper lying emotional problems. And it took me a little while to let the fuzz get down a little bit and maybe get through my first, fourth, and fifth step to realize what you all were talking about. You know, because see, I thought you put down a drink, everything's fine, you were cool. No, we were far from cool. A lot of things did stop happening. I haven't gotten a hangover since I got here, at least not one from booze. And I had, you know, no more DWIs, and that's nice, that's a plus. But there's a lot of other things that I had to deal with. I remember an old timer, I remember years ago, he said, God takes all your problems when you come to this program, and he'll just kind of dip them back to you just as you can handle them. And I never forgot that. And he also said he'd met a lot of spiritual people, and this was a long time ago. He said he'd met a lot of spiritual people, and he'd never met one that had reached the full height or width of this program. And I thought, yeah, there's always room for growth, you know. And I do an annual fourth and fifth step, and I can prove it. I mean, I can prove that I haven't hit the height or the width, you know. And But that's real good. I want to talk about deeper lying emotional problems. I left home, I think, four times between the ages of 15 and 17. And it wasn't one of these things that I just grabbed my stick in a bag and was mad because they weren't doing it my way. I had a plan. It never came to fruition right away. But my plan was to leave home, you know, not just I was mad. I wanted to continue in school. I wanted to get a job and just finish it out. And I never had a complete plan on anything. You know, I know there was a tread among businesses, and you get a boss every once in a while that would sit you down and, where do you want to be 5 years from now? You know, I never knew that. You ask me that today, I want to still be sober and still be alive and still have something left up here. But other than that, I never had a plan. I was living day by day, and I was unaware of it. When I was in high school, my plan was get out of high school. And after that was get a job, get out of this house, get out of this house. And My dad wasn't a bad guy. It's all perspective, you know. It wasn't a little house on a prairie, but it wasn't a mansion family either. So, you know, it was somewhere in the middle. And he was a real strict disciplinarian. He never read Dr. Spock. And I think somewhere along the line, he must have seen one too many of those James Cagney movies, or prison movies, because after I was about 14 or 15, you know, I stopped getting whippings or spankings or whatever you want to call them. And he started restricting me to the yard. And we lived in a suburban neighborhood, and he had a small yard, and I was always restricted to the yard. And I've recently been friends with, going back to being friends with one of my old buddies from the neighborhood. And he was saying, he said, yeah, he said, you know, he said, we'd be going out on Saturday, and somebody would say, oh, stop by and get mine. He said, no, I'm sure he's on restriction. He can't go out, you know. which led to my running away from home. I also, you're going to start to tell, I had a hard time dealing with life on life's terms. Back then, especially in my teens, I used to be short. No, it's true. You know, I was about 15, you know, you got that growth spurt, you know, and I just shot up. I was always impressed with guys who were strong, were big, you know. Guys you either loved or hated them because they were strong and big. And I started working out and doing all that stuff and then started, you know, every once in a while I'd, you know, run into one of the neighborhood bullies and you had to test your wares. Now, before you get a false impression that I was a tough guy, I was not a tough guy. I knew who the punks were, you know, and you know, it didn't take but a few shots, you know, catch them some fries, and you know, they had enough, and that was it. You know, I never got, you know, you never win a fight. I don't care how you come out, you never win. You know, you can walk around with your chest puffed out, but you know, you take your bruises. And I didn't get that many fights. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you go up against a big guy, and in my case, my baby sister's like 6'1", so I could have even fought her and still, you know, would have had a hard time. But if you won, or if it came a period of you won, then you lived on your reputation for 3 or 4 months before anybody would test you, you know, test your wares again. So it was just kind of thing. But I basically try to keep a low profile. I always try to keep a low profile. Just try to stay on the radar. Just mind my own business. You know, I was never one of the bullies, or never, well, wasn't big enough to be. But I escaped high school. I had thought towards the end of high school of going into the Marines. And that would have been a great shot, because we were in the middle of Vietnam back at that time. And, you know, God has intervened all through my life. And as I look back over things, you know, I can see where things have happened. I had a thing for this girl up the street. She was about a year older than me, which that would have been an older woman back in those days. And her boyfriend wasn't real thrilled about it. And he came out one day when he happened to be there when I came up with one of my excuses about some homework or something. And he came out and he saw what a run I was, so he didn't bother to, you know, kick my butt. But he started talking to me, and he started telling me about the Naval Air Reserve. Now, I knew what the Navy was. I knew what Naval Air was. I never heard of what the reserves were. And so he started telling me about it. Now, there were several things that appealed about that. First of all, for me, I like that idea. Anybody's been in the military, you're going to love this. Reserves only has 2 weeks boot camp. You know, it's a lot different than the 8 weeks and 10 weeks and 12 weeks that you other guys get. You know, he knows all about that. And the other thing was, and the thing that really caught me, was you could join while you were in high school. And I thought, oh, man. I thought, I'll never be able to talk my dad into signing me over. But I said something to my mother about it, and somehow or other, and she'd been in the Army Air Corps in World War II. And I don't know, I look back on it now, she probably said, look, if he goes in Naval Air Reserves, he probably won't have to go into combat. That's probably what she said. I don't know. And they were drafting guys in, you know, at that time. So anyway, he signed for me, and then I knew I was out. Now, in the reserves, when you go. I was going to meetings back then, but they were weekend meetings. And if you went for 6 months and you made a certain rank, and then you could go on active duty. And that's all I was waiting for. Do my 6 months and get on that active duty. And I knew he could never call the police on me again to, you know, get me back in the house, or, you know, have to track me down. And it was an escape. I didn't really start drinking until around that time. I had, I was supposed to be studying for senior exams, and this guy took me over to Baltimore. We stayed at a motel. He was an older guy. We stayed over there in a motel room, and I think he had other ideas, but by the end of the night, those ideas, I'm sure, were worse than, well, I'm not going to get into it. But anyway, any design he might have had on me, I took care of, because I got so drunk. And, you know, everything that ever happens to a drunk, I hit it all in that one night. You know, I don't think there was a, I don't think there was an orifice in my body that something wasn't coming out of before the end of the night. I'll leave it at that. You've got the picture. And I had a hangover, like, of all hangovers. Hangovers with me, that just came with the picture. That just came with it. I never thought anything about it. You know, it's like, how much is that beer? It's this much in a hangover. Okay. And I never had a huge capacity, but that never stopped me. You know, I just kept on. And basically, I became an alcoholic on beer. And I'm going to say something that at an AA meeting is probably blasphemous to say, but I didn't like hard stuff. I know, God forbid. Now, before it was all over, I probably drank anything that was too thin to chew. But basically, if I had my choice, it was either beer or... Eventually I was drinking Tom Collins, because when you go in a nightclub, you want to look like you got some class, and I don't want to sit there with a bottle of beer. I don't want to look like I, you know, so I tried a little bit of everything, and Tom Collins is about the best thing I know. That's kind of a ladies' drink, but it looks classy, and until you drink too many of them. And I went to Navy. I didn't get in any trouble there. I did 3 years active duty. I came out, and things were fine. I had a little minor skirmish with the local police up in Lake Huron, Tom's River, I guess it was. We were drinking underage at a lake, and some civilian had reported us. And we almost got in a lot of trouble at the base, not so much with the cops there. It was a $25 fine, which was a lot of money back then. But the CO of the base, there had been a lot of trouble with the Navy and Tom's River and Lake Huron. And so this religious captain came aboard, and he was going to make an example of the very next guys that got in trouble due to drinking. Ta-da. That was me and my drinking buddy. And the nicest thing about it was there was the next morning after the arrest, and that was the worst thing, you know, they took us down to the station, and we thought, okay, we'll go home. No, the shore patrol were there to meet us, and they took us back to the base, and we got written up. And the next morning there was a Marine lieutenant there, and he was a rough son of a gun. And anyway, he chewed us out and did all that. And we were in class. We were in school. I was a rigger, parachute rigger. I better watch how I say that. And so anytime anything was going to happen, it'd be a strange guy from another group, maybe in the third class or second class. He'd come in and talk to the instructor, and you'd be pulled out of class or whatever. And I mean to tell you, for the next 4 weeks, I was just sweating it every time somebody came in, because I thought, I'm getting my captain's mask. I'm in deep doo-doo. And I found out later that the Marine lieutenant, when it came in, he threw the report away. So, you know, another one, you know, check that out. You know, my story has never changed, but my perspective has. You know, I used to say that, well, for example, I never got fired from a job. Now, that's the absolute truth, okay? But upon further investigation and going back in your memory, my boss wanted so bad to get rid of me. And if he could have done it, he would have had me out of there in a heartbeat. It wasn't just a drinking, it was my attitude. You know, it was kind of a package deal. You know, when you're on a winning streak, go for it. And but I work for a utility company, and it's kind of like the government, you know. As long as you don't come in and smack somebody, or if you don't come in drunk, worst case scenario, they promote you. And I kept getting promoted, you know, for a few places anyway. And once I got sober, you know, my career stagnated, because they didn't have to put me anyplace. And but he didn't want me there. He didn't want me, and it was, you know, and he wasn't a direct confrontational kind of guy. I think he had a Napoleon complex. He was actually smaller than me. But anyway, the facts are that was part on his part, you know, but a lot on my part as to what was going on. And I will tell you that it took me a long time in sobriety to practice these principles on all my affairs like I was supposed to be. See, I didn't know you had to take them to work all the time, just parts of them. And I found out as time went on, you know, we learn more as we go on. I was drinking sporadically in the Navy. I was drinking on the weekend, or Friday night, you know, that was drunk night. And horrendous hangover, and that's it. I never drank during the week. I got out of the Navy. I got married, started a family. That's a little reversed, but anyway, there's a better way of doing it now. In fact, I just got married again about a year ago, and that was really neat. She wasn't even pregnant. And we were in love. It wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just some neighborhood tramp, you know, that we had a tussle. I mean, we were boyfriend, girlfriend, and the first one. And we had 4.5 years of marriage, and a couple of those years were good, you know. And I got worse. I got worse. And again, it goes back to alcohol. It's but a symptom. You know, deeper line was fine. It wasn't just my drinking. I was drinking maybe on the weekends or something. And again, not the whole weekend. I might get a little high on a Friday or something or other. Now, of course, if you went to a party or anything, well, that's a justified drunk. I mean, you know that's coming. And but there was more behind it. I went into an adult relationship with child qualities. See, I didn't know how you handled that. My impression is that you bring the check home every week and do certain things, and that's it. That's all you had to do. And there was a lot more to it than that. See, I didn't know what it all meant, you know. If the euphoria of, you know, newlyweds, you know, and the bliss and splitting the sheets 100 times in a year, you know, it was nice. But then, you know, then you had reality in there of, you know, dealing with each other every day. And I was not good at that. I wasn't mean to. I mean, I wasn't physical or anything like that. You know, I just didn't know how to be a grown-up. Now, if you ever hear her tell her side of the story, she might tell you something a little different. This is just my side of the story, and this is what I know, you know, to be true for me. She might have said it was all my drinking. I don't know. It doesn't matter. I'm just telling you. I'm giving you my perspective. After 4.5 years of marriage, she left. And I look back on that today, and I'm grateful it happened when it did. Not so much it was like, oh, I got rid of her. No, I was going to get a lot sicker before I was ever going to get well. And I didn't have to inflict that on either her or my son, you know. And I made it a practice after that when I was seeing my son that I wouldn't drink around him. Just to keep things straight. I had one time that I didn't do that. He was getting ready to leave to go to California, and I had him overnight. And I was drinking that night. And he was too young to really know. I was just telling him there were Cokes. But I passed out that night in bed, and I woke up the next morning, and I thought, where's my son? He was about 4 or 5. And he was out on the couch in the living room, and he was shivering. He didn't have any covers on him. And I can't tell you what that felt like inside when I walked out and saw that. Mm-hmm. You know, I covered him up, and I felt horrible. I just absolutely felt horrible, you know. And he had no idea what was going on. He said, Daddy, he said, you fell asleep last night. I put a cover on you, you know. God love the babes, you know, the babes in your arms. But anyway, I never forgot that. I drank for a few more years, and things got worse, you know. I picked up a couple DWIs. There was a word that was, as far as I know, was just starting to hit the tables when I got here. I never liked the word. It had I didn't like the ring of it. And I'm glad I didn't. And if it's one of your words, please don't take offense. This is just me. But the word was denial. And there's something about it just, and it was just barely starting to come to the table. Well, my original home group was a College Park group at College Park, Maryland. And if you've never been there, at least back in those days, it was kind of like Paris Island AA. And they, you know, we didn't get touch with our feelings, and we didn't talk to mama, didn't breastfeed us. You know, it was strictly the steps and what's going on, and, you know, and boy, have you got a sponsor, you know. Anyway, some guy, what about my time, was sitting next to me one night at the meeting, and he said something about being in denial. These guys never read that pamphlet on cross-talking. They just didn't. I don't know. I guess they didn't have any education. Because the old timer across the table just pointed his finger dead at him. He wasn't even leading the meeting. He said, boy, he said, that's just a fancy word for lying. Who's your sponsor? You know, you go, oh, I knew there was a reason. I always knew how to blend in with my environment. You know, I mean, if I was with a bunch of tough guys, wouldn't act tough, but I'd try to give them an impression that you are. If I was with people that were highly educated, I kept my mouth shut because I only look stupid and I don't sound too stupid until I start talking. Mm-hmm. So you knew when to kind of keep. When I came to AA, I sensed that there was a real hard line group there, and I wasn't going to get in there and start telling about what I thought I knew because I didn't know nothing, and I just kept it under the radar, and, you know, and it worked well that way because I had a chance to listen and learn some things. I was very blessed. My compulsion to drink was lifted the very night I came to AA, and by this time I was drinking daily. But to get to that point, one of the things I have to watch for, I'm starting to get a little older. As you notice, I was talking about denial, then I went off here. Now, as I get older, sometimes I won't come back. So if I don't come back, ask me after the meeting. But but what I was talking about denial was I did not suffer from that. I was not lying about my drinking. I didn't know. I was suffering from ignorance. I had no idea. I had no idea. I mean, there was nothing to it. I thought an alcoholic had to be a Skid Row bum. Now, I knew by this time my aunt was in AA, and she's a class lead. She was a class lead. but I never connected the two, that alcoholic and, you know, and it wasn't exactly a topic of discussion I had with my drinking buddies of who's the alcoholic, you know. So I didn't know anything about it, and we just didn't have the education back then. And now maybe there was programs on PBS, but God forbid I watch something with an education on it. But I mean, back then we didn't even have Oprah, so I mean, I had no, you know, there was no way at all. So I honest to God, I did not know what an alcoholic was. I had no clue, and I never thought I was. I was too young. I knew I was too pretty, but I was too young. See, I got here when I was 28, and back then that was considered really young. Nowadays we're getting teenagers in, we're getting young bloods in here, and all this, you know. That's what the professionals do. I kind of remember that. So I got my second DWI, and they awarded me a DWI class for good behavior. And this was back before they had all the touchy-feely, all the group therapy and sentence you to AA. It was just one night a week, and the only restriction was you couldn't drink that night. And so that was the thing. I knew there was a problem. This guy did not push AA. I knew about AA because I knew my aunt went to it. He didn't push AA. He just gave facts. And you know, and once in a while he'd show a movie or something, and it wasn't group discussion. It was just you sit there and listen. I was fascinated by it. I was fascinated. And then he said at some point, when any part of your life becomes unmanageable due to the use of alcohol, then you're an alcoholic. And then he gave some examples. If your wife's leaving you and you want to quit drinking, or if the doctor says you got an ulcer, and I thought, darn. And it kind of clicked. Another thing he told me, and I don't think it, subconsciously it hit me, but I don't think consciously it hit me until probably a couple years after in the program, was that, well, there was one other thing. There's a formula, and don't ask me what it was. I wouldn't bore you with it anyway, but there's a formula based on your body weight, how much you drank, and we had to learn that formula so you'd know when you were drunk, you know, and you know, how much, and I knew it, and I think I realized after I learned that formula that any night I went out to have a drink, you know, alcoholic math, any time I went out to have a drink, after 2 hours, I could get a DWI based on my body weight, and no matter if I seemed sober as a judge. And I think subconsciously it hit me the futility of trying to learn how to drink safe. The only way I can drink safe is like what I'm drinking right now. This is water. So I remember, too, that... my aunt had invited my and took my brother one time. He wanted to go to an open AA meeting, like a speaker's meeting. And he came back and told me all about it. That was so cool. He said, they really tell it like it is. I was afraid to ask her to take me to one. Not that I thought I had a problem. I thought, see, I knew one thing about AA. You guys were evangelists. And if I came in that room, it'd be, she's bringing it up. Yeah, come on, tackle him. And so I was afraid to go. I wanted bad to go hear a speaker, but I, you know, and probably it wouldn't have worked. Probably I would have tried to identify it or God knows what. But a guy was coming out that night from the very last night we were there. He was coming from AA to speak, and he spoke. I can tell you two things what I remember. He was 53 years old, and he drank a lot classier than I did. When I went to my blackouts and woke up somewhere, it was usually down the street in a car somewhere, who knows, somebody's strange apartment. He'd wind up in California, New York, or whatever. He was a much classier drinker than me. And, you know, people say, come in and listen and hear your story. I will be honest, I don't remember ever hearing my story. And I don't think I ever had to. See, I accepted the fact that I can't, you know, that I was an alcoholic and I could not take a drink, you know, safely. You know, and I never worried about the stories. I enjoyed speaker meetings, don't get me wrong. It wasn't until maybe a year or two later, my third sponsor had a very similar story to mine, and I never realized it. But it didn't matter. I mean, the bottom line is when I got here, my reservations were gone. If you have a reservation, you're going somewhere. I had no reservation. I didn't realize, and again, as I go into the program, I realize there's more and more to learn about this. And it wasn't until too long ago that I just realized, that, or I was told, that I had not accepted the first step for the first couple of months I was in the program, only part of it. I got that part down where you don't drink. But I had still not completely accepted the fact that my life was unmanageable, and the proof in that is I didn't have a sponsor. You know, I could say, oh, yeah, I got a DWI, I got arrested by the cops, oh, you know, I'm missing work, blah, 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 blah. That's not all of it. You know, I was still trying to fix the problem with the same brain that had created it without checking it out with somebody. And I was going to meetings and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But it took a while to, the thing of it was, to be honest with you, it wasn't that I was being a rebel. I really wasn't. But it seemed like most of the guys at the meetings were married. And there was a saying going on back then. We can't use it anymore today. But for historical value, I'm going to give you the quote, okay? And the quote was, stay away from the bars and the broads. Now, I thought, geez, I'm going with a girl. What am I supposed to do? Break up with her and all that kind of stuff, you know? And again, we can't use that term anymore. We've been sensitive to that. And it's a shame that, you know, you take a nice nightclub and you can call it a bar. I think that's the word. Is that the word? It must be the other word. I don't know. I can't keep up with it all. Next thing you don't want to vote. But anyway, So I found the first guy I found was single. And what happened was I got sober in October, and by December I was living in Maryland, working in Virginia. And, you know, about that time of year you get those 20% chance of snow, 30% chance of snow. And I was dating a girl over there, so I would stay over at her place. And I was starting to miss meetings, you know. And I'd never told her I was in the program. I mean, after all, she was only a girlfriend. Why did she need to know? And so I was a little shallow back then. And I had a drunk dream. I'd been going to one meeting a week for about 3 weeks, and I had a drunk dream, and it scared me. And it wasn't so much like, oh, my God, but it made me think, and I thought, you know, are you getting this program too easy? No, God knows. I hadn't even touched the surface. All I had to stop drinking. But I went back to one of my regular meetings on a Friday night, and there was my first sponsor. You heard me mention my third sponsor. I'm on my sixth sponsor right now, and it has nothing to do with it. We didn't bond, or I fired them all because they told me the truth. No, when you stay sober for a long time, sometimes you outlive people, you know, and that's what happened. They've all died, you know, except this last one, and we're not real sure. He's doing okay so far, so anyway. And I still want to outlive him, too. I mean, it is about me sometimes. But every one of those sponsors has brought something to me to help me work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I emphasize the, not mine. You would come here, oh, my program. Oh, God, my program got me here. And, you know, if you'd have been here then, you'd have known it was my program. There was no doubt about it, you know. I was a self-made man, and I had a plenty of defective parts putting me together. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I came to my first meeting, and I remember, we had the DWC. See, I think I did it again. I went off. I'm coming back. I was at the DWI class, and the guy spoke from AA, and he said, if you want to get your feet wet, he was a used car salesman. He said, I'll make sure you get to a meeting, and he put the card down on the table. Now, no, we didn't. We had no discussion inside the group of feedback and forth. It was just an instructor. So most of us, including myself for a while, thought we were just there because we had bad luck, and if that cop hadn't have been there and caught me that time. But I knew by this time there was something wrong, and I wanted so bad to get this guy's card. Well, the last night you're there, you have a test. And if you pass it, you walk out, and that's it, free. If you don't, you have to repeat the class, and the instructor said he would grade it if you wanted him to grade it to make sure. Well, I knew there was no doubt about it. I had the formula down. I'd been listening. I mean, this God had just opened up that little blank spot long enough for me to obtain some stuff. So I had a plan. It worked out, this one. And so we all sat down. We all had our little things, and we're taking a test. And so I went through that test like Grant took Richmond. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in Richmond. I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, I went pretty fast through it, okay? I was the first one done. I had no doubt that I had passed it. But my plan was everybody in the room had their head down taking this test. And I went up to the instructor because I needed to distract him. And I said, would you grade this? And when he did, when he started putting shit down, I just reached over and slid that card in my pocket. You know, I was a part-time thief at one time, so it was easy to do and go unnoticed. I went home that night, and I hope to God, up through the day, I've had my last drink, and it was two cans of Slip beers, not a drunk. I got drunk the night before. I had two cans of Slip beer. I went home that night and had two cans of Slip beer. I went the next day, you know, come to my first meeting, and the first meeting was October 17th, 1973. And that's my sobriety date. Not, I don't count October 16th. I count October 17th because that's the day I started doing it your way, at least trying to do it your way. I had tried to quit drinking them on my own a lot of times. And the end result was I had no idea. And again, a revelation recently. I had no idea I couldn't quit. I quit one time for a month. I said, okay. And just the alcohol obsession just came. You know, I had nothing to deal with it. I had no way to protect myself from that. I had a, here again, perspective. I used to say I had a religious upbringing. The reality of it is, I went to church on Sunday, and I went to Sunday school on Sunday. That's what you did back then, you know. I grew up in a little small town in Maryland, not particularly small, just, you know, and it was just kind of a crossbreed between Mayberry and the Stepford Wives on crack, okay? So, you know, everybody had problems, but you just kept it in your own house and kept it in your own yard, that kind of stuff, and nobody really knew. And if you could just kind of get a satellite shot of us on a regular week, you would see that, you know, the fathers, the husbands would get up in the morning sometime, you know, between 6 and 9, and they'd go off to work. And Mama would get the kids off to school, and everything looked normal. And that's how we grew up. So there was nothing real dramatic about any particular childhood stuff that was going on. You know, we weren't in the ghetto, and we weren't on Wall Street, you know, just an average little neighborhood. And it wasn't Mommy's fault or Daddy's fault. But I went to school. I went to Catholic school the first couple of years. And I went to church on Sunday and all that kind of stuff. I learned the book that they had. I learned it. I knew a lot about, you know, all this stuff. Intellectually, as a kid, they had a... I remember one time I was maybe second or third grade. Maybe 8 or 9. I don't know. Anyway, they had a catechism like spelling bee. It really wasn't a spelling bee, but it was just one of those things. The nun took you through the thing, and all the kids stood up, and you answered questions, and the last man standing won, you know. And I was the last man standing. And we hadn't even finished the book, and she took me through the rest of the book. I didn't miss a question. I got a plastic Jesus, and I wasn't even driving. You know, I said, that's really nice. So intellectually, and I had this thing in my head about, you know, that what God was and this, that, and the other. I think part of my blunt on God was that you had to get dressed up and go see him. I didn't like getting dressed up and then like disciplined and getting up and going to church on Sunday, which is school. My second mother died when I was about 10. My dad remarried a couple years later. We switched brands, and I liked that one better because I knew what the guy was saying when he was talking. You know, the sermon was in English, not Latin. And it was just fun, and the girls were friendlier. And anyway, I escaped Sunday school and church when I was about 15. They finally stopped making me go. I've heard many people, and it's written in the books, you know, about people talking about the foxhole prayers. And I never had a foxhole prayer in my life, you know, at least not until I got here. I never thought of that. The only way I've always believed in God. There was a God. I always believed that, but so what? I looked at that as a phase of my life that I went through. Is, you know, when you get through elementary school and you go to junior high or whatever they call it now, and you're in high school, I don't ever remember being in 11th grade in high school and then saying, okay, you're going back to 6th grade to, you know, because that part of my life was over. That was behind me. And that's the way I felt about God and praying and all that stuff. Say, okay, I learned all that. Okay, whatever. You know. And I never thought about it. I never thought about it until I got here. And somewhere in my first meetings, I heard this higher power, you know. Yeah. Who you think you're kidding? I read ahead. I saw God in there. You weren't kidding me. And I had a little bit of a block on it. I don't know. I guess my impression was if you believed in it, if you really, you were either born again or you know, or you just, every other word was God, God, God. And that was weak people. And that's why I looked at it, you know. It was just kind of weak people. And I don't know that I ever remember hearing fire and brimstone not in the Protestant one. I don't know if the, of course, you know, with us mackerel snatchers, anything you did, you know, was a sin, so. I don't know. I got about 50,000 years to do in purgatory anyway, so who cares? I moved on. I got in this program, and I heard what happened was I was in the program about a month, and I was listening, and I heard different people talking about problems they'd had that were going through. You know, job loss, this, that, and the other. They weren't drinking, and they were working towards a solution. And in that solution, I always heard God. I always heard the word God, or a higher God, if we understand him, or a higher power or something. And it finally hit me. I thought, well, if these guys can do it, I'm going to have to. The first step alone is not going to keep me sober. It may keep me from having to drink. I mean, I've seen people going around a long time. They work the first step and a little piece of the 12th step, and they think that's it. If that's it for you, then whatever. I want the whole package. I'm greedy. I want everything. And I remember I was about a month in the program. I knelt down next to the bed. I said, I'm going to do the third step. Because I came to believe, because in the second step, in the 12 and 12, it talks about belief meant reliance, not defiance. And when the old-timer said, if your way is so good, what the hell are you doing here? Pardon my French. Hell's in the Bible. Don't worry about it. Anyway, I knelt down next to the bed. Now, here's some old ideas. And I knelt down next to the bed, because you had to kneel when you prayed. That's an old idea. I still do, but you don't have to. And you have to have a formal prayer. Grace now, Amy. That didn't seem appropriate. So I'm going to do the Lord's Prayer. Ah, good. I got about two lines into it, and I couldn't remember it. Now, when I was a kid in school, I mean, you wouldn't even get arrested for saying it. We used to always say it. And I was plugging in every night, you know, my meetings. I could sing along with Mitch, but I couldn't do a solo. And if you're under 50, your eyes just glazed over when I said, sing along with Mitch. It was an old TV show back in the 50s, and they sang hit songs, and they had a little dot, and you could sing along. Okay, that's enough. You can go on Google and see the rest of it, or ask Don. He knows about it. He was there then. But anyway, I couldn't do it, and then I panicked, and I thought, what in the world? Where do I go from here? Thank God I'd remembered the Serenity Prayer, and I said the Serenity Prayer. And then, unbeknownst to me at the time, I said the most sincere prayer I'd ever said in my life up to that point. And I said, God, this is the only form of prayers I got. I just need your help. That was a prayer. You know, I've since found out that prayer is nothing more than lifting your heart and mind to God, talking to God, honestly. I still use the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer every morning, every night in my prayers. And it took me, I think, 7 or 8 months to actually memorize the Lord's Prayer again, you know. And I think when I started using it again, I think I was just showing him I knew it. I don't know if I was really doing it or not. I will tell you this, that over the years I have changed the words in it, not in the meeting, but at home. And the reason is, it's because sometimes I'd get up in the morning when I say my prayers, and I'd go, oh, Father, you're right in heaven, amen. And I'd said the whole thing, but I hadn't talked to God. I didn't, blah, 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 you know, I was just doing rote. Is that the word? Rote. Anyway, memorizing. So I changed the words so I would have to talk to God for me, and I would say, you know, our Father who lives in heaven, hallowed be your name. God, please give me this day so I can further do your will. Lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from evil and ego, for you as king. And I change it at night. So I don't ask God to forgive me my trespasses in the morning. I haven't had enough time to piss anybody off or anything. And I don't think. Of course, I'm married now. I don't know. But at night, and it's a similar prayer, and I just you know, same type of opening. And I say, you gave me this day my daily bread. I hope I did your will. And I ask you to forgive me my trespasses, you know. And you led me not into temptation, and we're going to talk about that. And yours is the kingdom, power, and whatever, wherever I may go with that. And then I take my inventory at night, you know, my 10th step every day. So it made me get focused, because I've had to change things and doing things a little bit. Because, you know, when you're doing something every day, sometimes you just kind of forget. I work at it all the time, and I've been working at it since I was a teenager, and every once in a while, I'll notice I've been doing the same exercise, but I'm not doing it strict. I'm not doing it right. And I change the movement just that much, and it makes a difference. I can feel the muscles sore next day, and I go, just when you think you had it down pat. And so it's with this program, too. I got to be on top of it. I talk to my sponsor on a regular basis. I've always talked to my sponsor on a regular basis. We may go 2 or 3 weeks. But I can bring him up to any part of my life in a five-minute conversation. And when he hears my voice on the phone, he'll know within a heart's breath if I'm okay or not. You know, he'll do it. And I can do that with my pigeons. I can tell the ones who are calling. I can tell if anything's wrong. I can tell because they're either, they're not, you know, you get a certain pattern, and they just broke the pattern. You know, and sometimes I listen with more intensity because they never call me in the morning. And, you know, it's like, oh, something's going on. What's going on? You know, everything's fine. No, it's not. Well, you didn't call me at, you know, this time in the morning. You always call in the evening. You know, and that's how my sponsor knows me. When I had one sponsor I had for about 17 years, and a good buddy of mine and I were talking about him afterwards at the meeting, and he said, you know, my sponsor knows everything there is to know about me, every little secret. And I said, you know, he's got mine too, you know. When I got another sponsor, I got a guy, and when I started to do my annual fourth and fifth step with him, I called him up and I said, look, I said, I was maybe 20 years sober at the time, and I said, I'm not going to go back and rehash everything there is that I've already dealt with. I said, I'm going to just kind of give you an update. Now, and along with that, if you hear anything, or if there's anything you want to know about me, you got carte blanche. You ask me any question about anything in my past, and we'll discuss it. See, a sponsor's here to help guide me through the steps, you know, and that's a one person I don't want to lie to. And I've said some pretty embarrassing things to a sponsor, believe me, and it was like, oh, my God, do I really say that? But I think it, this program is a miracle worker. It's a miracle worker, you know. The blessing that I had when I got here, the blessing, the gift that I had, was a gift of desperation. Now, we all talk about being physically, spiritually, emotionally bankrupt. I got to tell you, I was not physically bankrupt. I found out after I was here for a while, I had an ulcer. You know, I was on my way to a slow suicide, but not because I was going to pick up a gun, because I was picking up a drink. Spiritually, yes, I was absolutely bankrupt spiritually. And I did not know how much until I stayed in the program for a while and realized it. Because I still had little blocks of getting too involved with God, you know. That. But it didn't take long. Pain is a great motivator. You know, so is fear. I'm not going to stay sober on fear, but it'll get your attention. I was talking to somebody tonight, you know, and pain is a touchstone to all spiritual growth. That sounded beautiful, and you never heard it before, you ain't reading the 12 and 12, because I ain't that smart. And I think about that, and it doesn't mean you're beating yourself up or anything else. It's just, you get that attention, it's that brush, it's that, you know, okay, oh, that ain't right. I have a little, you know, when I was working, I'm retired now. When I was working, you know, I'd take my 10th step at night. And sometimes I'd have to take that 10th step during the day, you know, a little something that's emotionally out of balance or whatever. One of the things I've since learned how to do a quick inventory is when I'm disturbed, I go back to the 7th step. Not to ask God to take it, because I haven't identified it yet. But to go back, and there's a piece in there that helps me with an inventory. And the piece is, our chief activator of our character defects is our self-centered fear. We're afraid we're going to lose something we've already possessed, or we're not going to get something we're demanded. I can go right to that. When I'm angry, when I'm disturbed, whatever, and go, what are you afraid of? You know, that was tough in the beginning. That was tough. And, you know, I'm afraid of. I'm much of it. And I had to look at that. Then I could help identify whatever character defect was in there. You know, what I was afraid of, what was going to happen. It really did help me with taking those little quick inventories and moving on and taking care of business. I will tell you, when I worked, at the end of the night, I rarely had to go back and make an amend. Now, did I have a perfect day? Absolutely not always. And the only reason I didn't have to make amends at the end of the day was I had developed this little stomach alarm. And when I'm screwing up, when I cut you short, when I cut you off, when I'm being rude to you or angry with you, that alarm goes off. And it goes off and it tells me something's wrong. And I got to correct it. And I got to make that amend. It's ASAP, as soon as possible. The only thing, if you knew, you only have to do two things. Stop drinking and change your whole life. It's CYA. Now, I know you think you know what that means. It's not that word. It's change your attitude. And that's what I had to learn to do. I'm still learning. Change your attitude, change your attitude. Letting go of those old ideas. You know, when I first read that, I thought, oh, yeah, that's how I learned that when I was a kid. You can't do that. No, some of my old ideas barely have dust on them. Some of my old ideas are a couple months old, you know, and it doesn't mean I was going to hit for a drink, but it means there's a better way to do it. There's a better way of doing it. I've called my sponsor sometimes. I was writing a letter to somebody, and it was a very sensitive type letter, and I couldn't get the words that I wanted to say without hurting the person, and he gave me one word to put in the thing, and it changed the whole thing. Put it right in perspective, and it was very kind. And see, I don't have that ability. See, I still can't fix the problem with the same brain that's creating it. I still got to check in. Yeah, I tell you, it's a. I called New York a couple years ago about something I'd said to a guy in regard to some AA traditions, because I knew all that. I'm a very traditional guy. You know, traditional, or some people say dinosaur. I really believe black and white traditions. And we were having a discussion about one of the traditions, and this guy said, well, I heard this. I said, no, it's boom. And I thought about it later, and I thought, maybe I'm wrong. So I called New York the next day, and I talked to a lady who, tradition expert, I guess. And I said, okay, let me first of all give you the good news and the bad news. The good news is, at the time, I got 36 years in the program. The bad news is, I got 36 years in the program, and I think I know something. And I explained to her what I had discussed, and I was on the right track, but, you know, I wasn't quite there, and she corrected me and told me what all they did, and that was very important. And that's the other thing, too. You know, you can be on the right track in this program and still get run over. You got to be moving, you know. And I ain't talking about coasting, because even coasting's comfortable, but when you remember, you're going downhill. So keep that in mind. And I believe me, I've done everything I've told you about. I've coasted, you know, I've done all this stuff. I don't know. I've heard people over the years talk about, you know, they got 20, 25 years. And they had somewhere in the middle stopped going to AA for a couple years or whatever. And I will tell you, I don't identify with that at all. It's just not my experience. It's never crossed my mind to stop going to meetings. It's never crossed my mind that, you know, well, I got this thing now. It never crossed my mind that way at all. And it's just not. And I've been in meetings where I was only physically there. I've been to meetings where the only reason I was there was for the fellowship. And I'm not talking about picking up a chick. I'm talking about I just needed to be in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't care if I heard a message. I wasn't all I wanted because I was full of me. And I couldn't get out of me by myself. So I came to you. You know, and I've said that to me. I said, the only reason I'm here tonight is for the fellowship. I have got to be here. I've got to get out of my head. You know. I lived alone most of my sobriety up until a couple of years ago. And now I think I got a permanent roommate. And we got a wedding band to prove it. And the first several years, I had a lot of trouble. You know, and if two things were said to me at my first meeting. You never have to drink again as long as you live, one day at a time. And you never have to be alone again. Now, I will tell you that over the first several years, there was times I was alone. But the promise was still true. I wasn't doing my part. I wasn't going to a meeting that night when I felt lonely. I didn't call my sponsor that night. I didn't pray to the guy to my understanding. You know, I didn't call one of you guys and say, hey, I've since learned not to do that. And I've also learned little tricks of things. Even when you're home and it's during the day or whatever, so you're not going to go to a meeting, and that's fine. And you're just trying to get that, you know. Well, I had little tricks I used to do. Like if I went out, I lived in a duplex, so my last house was a duplex. So the lawn's about the size of a postage stamp. And I'd go out and I'd cut my grass. Well, some people didn't have somebody to do that. And so I'd go next door, because they'd be at work, and I'd cut their grass. It took all of 10 minutes. But I felt good when I did it. And I'd stop thinking about me for 2 seconds. And it just changed my attitude. I think about one story a friend of mine told me. And it's meant the world to me when I've heard it. And I'm going to try and give you a Reader's Digest version of it. But it's about this guy who had a spiritual awakening and wants to become and go into the ministry, and he wants to become a missionary, if I'm saying that right. So he does all those. He goes to missionary school, and he gets on this island with these natives, and he's there for several years. He makes good friends with them. He's teaching the word of JC and all that. And finally, after several years, and in the meantime, he's got this best friend, this guy that was always helping him, you know, this native. So finally he's getting ready to leave, and he says, you know, I'm going to go back to the States. So they're getting ready to have this big, big party for him. And his buddy disappears. His man, Friday, is gone. And he said, where is he? I want to see him before he goes, you know. And so the day the ship comes in, still his buddy's not there. And finally his buddy shows up, and he's got this beautiful conchal shell, this beautiful shell. And there's only one place you can get it, and everybody knew that. You had to make a very dangerous trip by boat, canoe they had, to go across to this other island where there was riptides, sharks, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, you're pretty much a life-risking thing to get there. And he's looking at this conical shell, and he said, my God, he said, you shouldn't have done that, He said, this is just too beautiful. And he said, that's not my gift. He said, my gift was a journey. And that's what I think about, you know. I don't think a lot of people ever feel that I've done things for people sometimes. And I'm not patting myself on the back. But they will never get out of it what I got out of it, trying to do it or making it happen. And even better when I can do it anonymously. Because I get on a high. I can feel myself. I'm almost laughing inside. It's like, they'll never know who did it. You know, and it's just, and that whole time, my endorphins just kicked in. And I'm feeling good, you know. And you guys taught me stuff like that. Yeah, this is not something I thought of, you know. Give something to somebody else and not expect something in return. Or at least, you know, get a pat on the back for it. I was telling one of the old timers about it not too long ago, and he was saying, yeah, I always like to get that pat on the back. I said, I do too. That's why I avoid it. And it was just one of those things. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you people. I'm not one of those people who came in here kicking and screaming. You know, I've gone back. You know, I knew when I got here, I knew you were my people. My first meeting, we were carpooling. And this guy got in the back seat with me, and he slid over. He had one of those voices that came out of your feet. I don't know if he could sing or not, but if he could have been a millionaire. Deep voice. And he said, so you got a problem with your drinking, huh, boy? And I knew from that minute on, you guys understood. Now, if he'd have said that a week or two before that, I'd have been ready to fight. But I felt that understanding. It was the language of the heart. We talk about it all the time. It's not the words. It's there. It's the language of the heart. I mean, how can a guy, a college professor, talk to a Skid Row bum and you understand each other? Here. Right here. You know. And I was a Skid Row bum up here. I was a Skid Row bum. Believe me. There's nothing that, you know, that some of those guys hadn't done. I hadn't thought about doing it. Maybe done some of it. And the only reason I hadn't hit the jails is because nobody saw me doing it sometimes. And that's been taken care of. But go back, and when you said, you know, half measures will avail you nothing. You know, you weren't kidding. You know, I've had to go on. I've had to do those amends I didn't want to do. And I will tell you this. If you'd asked me when I was 5 or 6 years sober, have you made all your amends? I could have honestly told you yes. It was the truth. But I was honest, but it wasn't the truth. And I say that because there were things I didn't remember. I was probably close to 20 years sober when I remembered an amend. And I was listening to a pigeon's 8-step. You know, I don't know if anybody just knew. If I say pigeon, they're using sponsor. That's what I'm talking about. Anyway, and I realized that I had to go back, and there was another amend that I had to add something to. You know, I realized a few years ago there was another amend that I needed to make to my ex-wife. It came up in a memory bump. And I did, and I wrote her a letter under the guidance of my sponsor. See, I don't do these things without my sponsor, you know. Is he the answer man? No. But he's got the experience, and he knows how to point me in a direction that I'm supposed to be pointed in, you know. And he doesn't judge me, you know. And he's there to guide me through these steps. I want to thank Sam again for you guys allowing me to come down here tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to be down here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you guys. God bless.